This is Wayne Wagner for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is designed for a print and visually impaired audience. We continue with the reading of the book Blind Justice by Judge Craig Brown. We pick up in Chapter 10 with the trial of Walter Rogers. I spoke directly to the defendant, as I sometimes do, to make sure they understand what they are doing and the nature of the plea. His answers rang true, but they just didn't sound right. Sometimes judges have to rely upon gut instincts. I felt that something here was not quite right, so I ordered a sentencing service plan. A sentencing services plan is often sought when there are special circumstances for a given defendant, such as HIV, a substantial history of substance abuse, mental illness, family history, and that type of thing. These plans provide judges with much more information about the defendant than they would otherwise have. 60 days passed while the plan was being prepared. I kept the Rogers case on my docket since I was familiar with it. When I got the plan, I was stunned. Educational records indicated that Rogers had an IQ of 56. Dorothy Dix, the state mental hospital, found that Rogers had a current IQ of 52. Any criminal defendant has to have the capacity to know right from wrong. Persons with IQs less than 70 are generally presumed to be mentally incompetent to stand trial. Mr. Rogers did not have the capacity to stay on trial. I declined to take the plea, and the state dismissed the charges against Rogers. Imagine what would have happened if my gut instinct found nothing wrong with the plea, if I had not questioned the defendant's capacity. That's what gut checks are for, to read between the lines and sift through the evidence. Sometimes it actually works. Sentencing services saves the state millions of dollars every year. A conservative estimate of cost imposed for imprisonment of defendants who are diverted from prison was $19.6 million, compared to the sentencing services budget of $2.8 million. Since sentencing services works with high-risk offenders, the cost of their imprisonment would be even greater. In 2007-2008, 74% of the 1,490 sentencing services plans presented across the state of North Carolina were accepted by the court. The bottom line is this. By providing more information to the courts make better judgments about the defendants before them. Sentencing services also saves the state money by diverting a substantial number of defendants from the prison system. In the Rogers case, justice meant a dismissal of the charge against him. Chapter 11, Seven Good Ideas. A new, more independent judiciary. The funding of the North Carolina judicial system is pathetic. Today, I suspect that we've slipped from the 48th worst funded system in the United States to the 50th, with only about 1.7% of the state budget. Given the proud progressive history of our state, that is simply ridiculous, especially where our judicial system is counted on to solve many of our problems. We simply do not have the resources to do the job. Then, Assistant District Attorney Jim Harden told me a long time ago that any change in the system requires resources, which means money, money, money. Today, North Carolina is pretty much broke, so you won't see any of that soon. I don't expect real state budget growth for the next 3 to 5 years, particularly when you subtract inflation. Increased inflation will be one of the consequences, since we've been borrowing money from China anyway. But we can start with some suggestions I make, which ultimately will save money at the state and county levels, and study the rest of the problems in the meantime. When you look at history, you realize that change doesn't happen at once, but it starts to form and gel in the bad times. If you want a historical example, just look at the New Deal. When you look at our judicial system, you will see that the way we do things now is the same way we did things with the New Deal 70 years ago, or even the beginning of the Republic or English common law. North Carolina has changed, too, from about 3 million people in 1970 to about 9 million today. We are now the 10th largest state in the country, and it is time that we started acting like it, by at least having a judicial system that is in the 21st century, rather than in the 18th century. Any systematic change begins by looking at the system itself. Maybe some Class 3 misdemeanors need to become infractions rather than crimes. Maybe the district attorney's office does not need to plead down minor misdemeanors, namely when the accused has no record. I suspect that any district attorney's office might like that. Criminal magistrates may like to handle more infractions, too, instead of focusing on probable cause and setting bond only, as it is the case now. Maybe there ought to be two divisions within the magistrate's office, one for probable cause in the setting of bonds, and the other for a criminal magistrate's court. Since you can get at least two criminal magistrates for the cost of every judge, that might even be less expensive than the current way we do business. All the smaller crimes may not need to be in district court, and I know district court judges might like that too. We already do that for minor traffic violations. All this smaller stuff doesn't need to be in district court. All of the low-grade felonies may not need to be called felonies either. We might call them super misdemeanors and keep jurisdiction in superior court with the same sentences, but with a right to a jury trial except on appeal. Some of our superior court judges need more work to do anyway. Not in Durham, perhaps, but in other judicial districts across the state. The judicial branch also needs to be more creative in how we generate more revenue. Lord knows, history has shown us that we can't depend on the General Assembly. I'm tired of all the judges in the state being paid the lowest amount of money in the Southeast. And I'm tired of our clerks having to work two or three jobs to make ends meet. I do not think 30 seconds to 2 minutes in front of a judge is enough time to gather all information about the case. This means moving down to lower levels where they might have more time to deal with the matter. I also think we need to take some of the politics out of the selection of judges. We should reserve popular elections for those judges who are not retained. While all judges now are nonpartisan, I don't think that is good enough. We might also need to think about the terms of all judges, which means district court judges, because every other judge in the state already has an 8-year term. Maybe new judges should have the retention action midway through their term, at the 4-year point. The bottom line is the status quo is not necessarily the best way to do things. Change is constant, and our judicial system needs to recognize it better. We also don't need to change everything either. I suggest the formation of a new Futures Commission, which needs to be made permanent. As I said, change is constant, which is why the Futures Commission, or some entity like it, needs to be permanent. I have not even begun to discuss the changes in technology. By the way, I think the computer has changed a lot of things, like speedy access to information. They will get it faster, too. The problem with computers is that they generate information so quickly that people do not have time to think about it creatively. I could write this chapter of the book forever, but I No, I have to stop at some point. Wrapped up in this chapter, you will find about 60 new ideas. That is enough to start with, since I think you have some thoughts of your own, too. After all, my dad told me in high school that we was always better than I. Over the years, some of the brethren and others have beaten that into my head. Who knows? I may have learned something from them. The Scarlet F. People who receive a felony conviction are forever limited in terms of employment opportunities, access to public housing, and/or educational opportunities. Just as in Nathaniel Hawthorne's The Scarlet Letter, they might as well be marked with a Scarlet F. With such limitations on their future, many lose hope. Others see little choice but to pursue a lifetime of criminal activity. Most crimes are committed by young people between the ages of 16 and 30. Most people grow up, have a career, get married, and have a family. There should be an easier way to remove a felony conviction or convictions from a person's record. Right now, the only way to do so is under very limited circumstances or by gubernatorial pardon. I'm not speaking here of violent felonies. Those scarlet letters should follow a person forever. But in the case of minor felonies committed while the offender was young, I suggest the creation of a mechanism to expunge those felonies from an offender's record. That could be accomplished by an expansion of present law, with hearings to be conducted by a resident superior court judge. in such cases. An offender could present evidence as to why the conviction should be removed from his record, such as years of good behavior, church and community involvement participation, drug or alcohol treatment, job training, or other positive steps that the offender has taken. Such an opportunity would require a minimum time of good behavior and could be available only for lower-level nonviolent felonies. Most people do change as they grow older. Removal of the Scarlet F would reflect their positive changes in a manner that is not threatening to the local community, since the offenses are required to be nonviolent. In the same way, and subject to the same restrictions, an offender might also be able to remove nonviolent misdemeanor convictions. Just a thought. Truancy Court. After a summer conference in 1998, Durham District Court Judge Ann McCown brought the idea of school-based truancy courts to Durham. She was intrigued. She thought that if we reduced truancy, that in turn would reduce chronic truancy, which in turn would reduce the number of high school dropouts. In turn, fewer dropouts might reduce crime. That seemed to me a very logical and rational way of looking at things when the state of North Carolina has a 30% dropout rate. District Court Judges Richard Cheney and Marcia H. Moray agreed to join the effort. In the fall of 1998, three school-based truancy courts went into initial operation at three different middle schools in Durham County. The purpose of truancy court was first to determine the cause for truancy and correct the situation. Students had many reasons for being truant, from the dog ate my homework, to I missed the bus, to their parents' divorce, substance abuse issues, mental health issues, and the like. The causes of truancy were many in number, sometimes in combination with a great deal of variety from case to case. If you could catch and identify the cause of truancy early, you could prevent the slide down the slippery slope. Students who continue to be truant are referred to juvenile court through an undisciplined petition. Such petitions allow students to be placed under supervised juvenile probation for up to 6 months. Parents who do not take appropriate steps to make sure that their children are in school can be charged with a compulsory school attendance violation, a Class 1 misdemeanor under North Carolina law. It carries a penalty of up to 100 days in jail and a $1,000 fine. Those cases are referred to the courthouse-based truancy court as well. The purpose of all truancy courts is to make sure that all students are attending school on a regular basis and that their parents make sure that they get there. As time went on, the goals of truancy court expanded to include, second, academic performance, and third, student behavior. The truancy court team often comprised of a judge, an assistant principal, a social worker, a guidance counselor, a school resource officer, and someone who spoke Spanish. Each school could tailor the team to the needs of the individual school. When I served as co-chair of the Truancy and Gang Prevention Committee in Durham, it became very clear that we would never solve the crime or gang problems unless we cut the dropout rate. High school dropouts are the prime candidates for gang involvement. Moreover, dropping out of school places the student at greater risk for criminal involvement, substance abuse, underemployment, teen pregnancy, and poverty. In my criminal courtroom, I once did a survey to see how many of the defendants in the courtroom were high school dropouts. While the results were not scientific, high school dropouts accounted for about half of the criminals in the courtroom. In 2003, working with the Durham Public Schools and community leaders, we expanded truancy court to include all 10 middle schools in Durham County. I became the truancy court judge at Choning Middle School. At the time, Choning had the worst truancy problem of all the middle schools in Durham. It was dead last in terms of student attendance, 10th among the 10 middle schools in Durham County. With the help of the truancy court team, we worked the problem. Truancy court started out once a week. As the problem declined during the second year, we went to once every other week. By the end of the third year, Choning ranked fourth among the 10 middle schools in attendance. Academics had improved by about 11%. End-of-grade testing had gone up by more than 15%. Simply stated, school-based truancy courts work. With little additional expense for the public, I might add. Everyone on the truancy court team, including the judge, is a volunteer. Judges can be real judges, lawyers, or lay people. The dropout problem is huge. I think every school district in the state should have truancy courts in all middle and all high schools and in the worst attended elementary schools. There are too many elementary schools to staff them all. We also need some legislation. Up to now, truancy courts have existed by bluffing. Put another way, truancy court judges have no legal authority to help students by ordering a student into after school to take an ADD evaluation, a mental health assessment, a substance abuse assessment, and the like. Truancy court judges need to have limited authority to help truant students. With state budget cuts in education this past fiscal year, we may not or should not make truancy courts statewide now. After all, the schools have fewer resources and fewer teachers to teach our young people, and that is their primary job. I also believe that we need to raise the age that high school students can drop out gradually in the first place. If they drop out, they also need to drop out to a full-time job, not the streets. In my home state of Iowa, that was the law when I was in high school. By the way, Iowa and other states have some good ideas, too. But it was just too darn cold for me to stay in Iowa in the winter, especially when I delivered the Des Moines Register. I still miss Iowa some, but not from November to March. Lastly, we also need to raise the age of jurisdiction in our juvenile courts, maybe in combination with the increased age for dropping out of high school or not. At the outset of this chapter, I told you I would have about 60 good ideas, and I'm only in the second subsection. You may have heard some of these ideas before. I have always been an advocate of stealing good ideas. I did so with TROSA, and I did so with drug treatment court. Those weren't my ideas. I simply stole them. GPS alcohol and drug monitoring and house arrest bracelets. Bruce Roberts, an entrepreneur from Brevard, North Carolina, is the father of continuous alcohol monitoring, or CAM, in the state. CAM is an ankle bracelet that measures alcohol concentrations through the sweat that comes through the skin. Roberts first introduced this concept in 2004 as a means of providing abstinence from alcohol or to serve as an alternative to jail or prison. Since it is a private pay alternative, the courts have been reluctant to use it, and many clients are unable to afford it. Slowly but surely, the idea of using CAM to save jail or prison bed space and enhance or prove abstinence is gaining steam. The North Carolina criminal justice system should embrace the latest in modern technology by adopting and using new ankle bracelets that detect an individual's use of alcohol. Over time, this technology will be expanded to detect opiates, cocaine, methamphetamines, and marijuana as well. The same technology also provides for GPS tracking of any person with the same ankle bracelet. This new ankle bracelet technology provides real-time data. Since it is a digital-based technology, cell phones can be used for implementation. And the technology will only get cheaper and better over time. At present, the new ankle bracelets cost about $10 per day. At first, $10 per day may seem like a lot of money, but consider the fact that it costs a minimum of $78 a day to keep someone in jail in North Carolina, and even more per day in our prisons. In North Carolina, at least 98 of our 100 county jails are filled beyond capacity. Our prisons are also overcrowded. Many of our incarcerated offenders are drug addicts. By using this bracelet in conjunction with drug treatment, nonviolent offenders could be released from jail or prison, but still monitored on a regular basis. Not just a regular basis, a 24/7 real-time basis. If they slip up, they go back to jail or prison. To accommodate this technology, we would have to change the way law enforcement does some of its business. For example, we would have to develop rapid response teams to pick up offenders who violate the terms of their release from jail or prison. Given the thousands of people that we would be dealing with, we would also have to ramp up substance abuse treatment to accommodate a heavily addicted population. The GPS feature of the new bracelet could also be used to enforce house arrest by creating an electronic fence around which the individual could not go. Just as with alcohol and drug monitoring, the GPS feature would also have real-time, 24-hour-per-day, 7-day-a-week coverage. In North Carolina, statutes regarding pretrial release would have to be expanded to permit the full use of this technology. But the 21st century is here, and we need to change our criminal justice system to use the present technology. We may also need to expand the use of GPS technology for house arrest purposes. Since we can now place someone in house arrest and verify, we also might need to redefine punishment and what it means and gives all judges the discretion to use GPS technology in nonviolent cases, excluding career criminals, which is where the integrative computer history will be of help. You don't have to take my word for it. Look at www.housearrestbracelets.com on the internet. North Carolina also needs to look at where the judicial discretion to use a house arrest bracelet is permitted in other states such as Michigan and Ohio. We also need to evaluate the concept of house arrest in light of this new technology, which did not exist when the initial house arrest statutes were drafted. I'm not sure there are other states in the country using GPS bracelets too. Once again, we don't need to reinvent the wheel because I've always liked stealing good ideas from other places. You might notice the pioneers like Ken Hewitt are also controversial. The controversy follows the novel idea that he is spreading across the state. Hewitt is a graduate of UNC Chapel Hill, a dentist by profession, and the first Drug Treatment Corps graduate from the Orange County Drug Treatment Court. Both Hewitt and Roberts are passionate people and pioneers in bringing the bracelet technology to the state. Even positive change can be controversial to those in the status quo. An internet court system. Most courts across North Carolina and the United States have failed to keep up with the advent of computer technology. Just like 100 years ago, we still depend upon the use of paper, especially paper forms, for the issuance of criminal citations, criminal warrants, civil papers, and the many different types of documents that are included in the usual criminal and civil court files. With the implementation of computer technology, the internet, and scanner technology, we need to do better than that. Even now, on a limited basis, law enforcement officers can send electronic citations to some clerk's offices across the state of North Carolina, and many administrative offices' court forms are available on the internet. This frees law enforcement from taking the time to deliver copies of citations to the courthouse, since they can do so electronically. Imagine if we could have computers in all patrol cars such that they could access warrants and citations and email them and information to the magistrate's office before they arrive. The criminal magistrate could then print copies of the various warrants and citations out, serve them upon the accused defendant, and then email the various warrants and citations to the clerk's office for processing. With computers in patrol cars, it would make access to integrated computer criminal histories, which are now being implemented in Wake County prior to integration statewide, more convenient. Likewise, civil attorneys could file court actions electronically in the clerk's office with a payment of the usual fees per same. The clerk's office could maintain secure e-files for both criminal and civil matters. Since these matters are public, the court files could be accessed electronically by all parties for review of same. Moreover, with the advent of the BlackBerry, any member of the public might be able to access this same information from their mobile phone. The federal government is already favoring electronic filing of all legal papers, and I'm not sure they even accept paper transfers anymore. But before we take that step, present computer technology in the criminal justice system needs to be updated. The private sector is far ahead of the public sector in terms of updated computer technology. We need to start with the basics and build from there. I imagine the day when we could have paperless courtrooms in North Carolina. Instead, we would have electronic courtrooms where warrants and paperwork normally contained in a paper court file could be secured electronically and accessed by any party, their respective attorneys, and the public. Obviously, there would be some cost involved in making this transition, just as there is cost involved in making healthcare records available on the internet. There are also the usual questions regarding computer compatibility and computer security. But at the beginning of the 21st century, we need to consider cheaper ways of transferring and accessing information that has been carried on paper in our court system for hundreds of years. Given our present level of technology, not taking into account future advances, we can begin moving in this direction now rather than later. I realize that shifting to an electronic computer system will be expensive up front, but I also believe it will result in substantial savings thereafter, considering the extensive reduction of paper. Computers have changed everything. Their expanded use in the judicial system would also make the judicial process more open and transparent to the public. But we need to remember to think about the information or ideas that a computer spits out automatically. After all, the criminal and civil judicial systems are run by people, not machines. That is a good thing, too, because with more information, the public might understand the judicial system and the judicial process better. I think that is a good idea, too. The least important court is the most important court. I know. Traffic court, supposedly, is not the most important district courtroom. However, it usually carries the largest volume and is where any district court judge meets hundreds and thousands of ordinary people, many of whom vote. For that reason, I consider traffic court my most important courtroom, and I always treated the public and all attorneys with respect and humor. Speaking of traffic court, I believe that our present driving while license revoked law needs to be changed to reflect reality. Many people who do not have a license drive anyway, whether to their children's school, work, or the nearby grocery store. North Carolina does not have an adequate mass transit system, and most people need to drive to get to where they need to be. I'm not contending here that the present driving while license revoked should be changed entirely. Rather, it should be amended. The law should be strengthened to punish people who drive when their license is revoked for a driving while impaired, DUI, conviction. On the other end of the spectrum, the present driving while license revoked law should be weakened regarding drivers whose licenses were revoked for failing to appear or failing to take care of another minor traffic matter. I cannot tell you how many people appeared before me whose license was revoked due to an unpaid seatbelt violation or minor speeding ticket that they forgot. Perhaps this section of the law needs to be called driving while suspended, to give the presiding judge the formal discretion to waive all fines and costs if the offender has taken care of the underlying traffic matter. I did that on the bench anyway, in the least important circumstances. Tough choices. A new 1,000-bed medium-security prison costs about $100 million to build and $50 million per year to operate thereafter. That is the way that we have always handled prison overcrowding. We just build more prisons. But should we? Instead, why don't we spend the same amount of money on substance abuse treatment and increase substance abuse deferrals? Given that the theft of pine straw is a felony, we also might want to review all nonviolent felonies to see if the punishment fits the crime, instead of just looking at it each time the judiciary creates a new felony. Bit by bit is the normal way that government works, but we have not had a comprehensive overview of criminal law in North Carolina since the 1970s. A lot has changed since then. The population of North Carolina has almost tripled since 1970, and the Hispanic population in the state has mushroomed. We know much more now about substance abuse and addiction than we did in 1970. Given current advances in alcohol and drug treatment, I would even go so far as to predict that addiction 20 years from now will be treated like depression is today. The advent of the house arrest bracelet also could change the nature of future kinds of imprisonment. Put another way, we must balance traditional imprisonment against meaningful house arrest. For example, would low-risk offenders in our jails that have work release be better punished by house arrest with a GPS house arrest bracelet on them? The point here is that the nature and types of punishment need to keep up with the development of technology. Given that reality, I believe we need a statewide board to consider the impact of these technologies as it affects the traditional ways that we have operated our criminal justice system in the past. Yes, we still need prisons for violent offenders, but maybe there are other ways to punish and monitor nonviolent offenders and rehabilitate them, short of a costly prison environment. Appropriate use of the GPS bracelet may reduce the need for jail space, or at least slow it. Since we now have an offender pay system for the GPS bracelet, we need to find a way to pay for it. North Carolina should modify wage garnishment laws for all ankle bracelets as they develop, and alcohol bracelets for DWI offenders and their mandatory drug treatment, too. If the use of such technology saves prison bed space in the Department of Corrections, the state might kick in some of the savings. The same might be true for county jail space for each individual county. Boy, this was a fun chapter to write. By the way, it's just for starters. I have even more ideas. But I know that we need to think about the ideas I've started with first. I have only been thinking about them for the past 25 years, and I'm not constrained by the Code of Judicial Conduct, so I got to let them go. We have to build some consensus based on further study. Some of the study might even be free. The Sanford Institute for Public Policy at Duke University might have an interest. So might its counterpart at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, as well as a school of government there, or the Criminal Justice Department at North Carolina Central University. After all, we are all in this together, and I think it's time to break some new ground. Think about it, and let's get started. Chapter 12, The War is Lost. No, I'm not talking about the war in Iraq or the war in Afghanistan. Rather, I'm talking about a war right here at home, the war on drugs. Since the 1970s, we have spent hundreds of billions of dollars building prisons and incarcerating defendants for various drug violations in North Carolina and through the United States. Look at what we've accomplished. Arguably, today the drug problem is as big as or bigger than it was 35 years ago when the war on drugs began. Like it or not, drugs have become a daily part of life for a significant portion of our population, especially young people between the ages of 15 and 30. Popular culture continues to glorify drug use. Likewise, the drug cartels may have changed their nationality, but they are still as big and as powerful as they were 35 years ago, arguably more so. The war on drugs is out of balance. We focus far too much of our resources on punishment instead of prevention and rehabilitation. Moreover, the United States incarcerates more than 2 million people each year, a quarter of which are incarcerated for drug violations. More than 80% of all crime is committed by people with drug and alcohol problems, according to FBI statistics. I frankly don't think it that anyone believes that we are winning the war on drugs, especially when you consider the sizable amount of resources that we have devoted to the issue over the years. The drug war now is also different from 1973 when it started. Crack cocaine did not exist then. Methamphetamines were not the rampant problem that they are today. A number of new prescription painkillers are now readily available. These three drug types alone can be instantly addictive rather than addiction that occurs as a result of chronic use. The point of this chapter is not to argue for the decriminalization or legalization of drugs in the United States. I'll leave that argument to others with far greater experience with the issue than I have. I don't want the United States to be like Holland. Instead, what I want to do is ask a long series of questions about what we are trying to accomplish with our current drug policy, stimulate discussion, and lead to the formulation of new strategies to combat the drug problem in our country. We cannot afford to continue attacking the drug problem as we have in the past. Frankly, we can't afford it. The national appetite for drugs is as great as or greater than it was when the war on drugs began in 1973. Since the evolution of man, man has sought to alter his consciousness through the use of various drugs. To accomplish this, various cultures have used alcohol, peyote, marijuana, opium, and any number of other drugs. I don't believe that mankind's appetite for conscious-altering drugs has changed or will change over time, especially among the young. For many of our young people, drug use is simply a phase of life that they pass through. For others, it can become a lifelong addiction. There is a clear distinction between casual use and addictive use of various narcotics. Moreover, all drugs are not created equal. The present schedule of narcotics recognizes this. Schedule 6 is marijuana. Schedule 4 is ecstasy. Schedule 2 is cocaine. And Schedule 1 is heroin and methamphetamines. Of course, there are other drugs, but especially prescription drugs along this spectrum. But for the purposes of discussion, these are the big five. Most of the money spent for illegal drugs involved the use of these five narcotics. Then there are the legal drugs, such as tobacco and alcohol. Arguably, these legal drugs are worse than their illegal counterparts. After all, tobacco kills about 500,000 people a year, and alcohol kills approximately 100,000 a year in the United States. Any realistic drug policy should also consider categorizing the use of tobacco and alcohol and controlling their use as much or more than those of illegal drugs, given their deadly impact. After decades of experience in the North Carolina court system as an attorney and as a district court judge, I can safely say that marijuana is far less toxic than alcohol. I have never seen or heard of any defendant who engaged in violent behavior while under the influence of marijuana. Ingesting marijuana leaves you stoned, silly, and stupid, but it rarely leads to any acts of violence. Of course, for some people, it may be a gateway drug to harder drugs down the road. But alcohol and tobacco can also be gateway drugs to their harder cousins. Before I begin discussing each of the various narcotics that I've identified above, let me ask some general questions that apply to all controlled substances. First, should we devote jail or probation time for simple possession of the various substances? Should we allow defendants who are charged and convicted of possession of various substances the ability to expunge their records after rehabilitation or after a certain number of years? We need to be mindful that a minor felony drug conviction stays on a person's record for life and can prevent meaningful employment. Should we devote prison space to convicted nonviolent drug offenders? Should we differentiate between various substances? Should we make legal drugs such as alcohol and tobacco illegal given their health effects? Should we devote prison time to chronic substance abusers who have not committed violent offenses? Should we increase drug prevention education? And should we increase rehabilitation services for all substance abusers? Scientific studies indicate that approximately 20% of our population has genetic tendencies toward addiction. Should we treat addicted people as criminals? Or should we treat them as having a medical health problem? Or both? The first drug that I'm going to talk about is marijuana, a Schedule 6 drug under our drug schedule. What are we trying to accomplish with our present drug policy toward marijuana? As I said above, marijuana is less harmful than alcohol or tobacco. Arguably, a stoned defendant is far less dangerous and or violent when compared to a drunken defendant. Both may need rehabilitation services to be sure. But given that marijuana is less intoxicating or dangerous than alcohol, should it be treated criminally as a more serious offense? Is it simply a question that we do not have a scientific way of measuring the level of intoxication for marijuana as we do alcohol? Is it a cultural and historical bias? Some minorities consider the war on drugs to be a war directed at them. What are we accomplishing by criminalizing the casual use of marijuana by some of our young people? Is the punishment appropriate to fit the crime? Or should it be a crime at all? Or should casual use of marijuana be legalized? Is even the addictive use of marijuana so harmful that it needs punishment by a criminal sanction? Is it appropriate to use marijuana for medicinal purposes? As modern medicine continues to evolve by the creation of additional life-saving therapies and chemotherapies, should the use of marijuana be encouraged to prevent or limit harmful side effects of such medications? If we legalize marijuana, will that result in the increase of overall illegal drug use in the United States? Given that about 5% of marijuana users use it as a gateway to harder drugs, should we criminalize marijuana? In April 2009, National Public Radio reported that 45% of all drug arrests in the United States were for possession or trafficking of marijuana. Assuming this percentage is true, is it appropriate to devote such a large portion of law enforcement and judicial time for marijuana offenses? Let me turn now to the use of ecstasy, a Schedule 4 controlled substance under our controlled substance schedule. 30 years ago, use of ecstasy was legal when prescribed by a doctor. Given the adverse health effects of casual, chronic use of ecstasy, should we outlaw simple possession? Should we outlaw the distribution of ecstasy? Or should we treat ecstasy use as a medical health issue instead? As a Schedule II controlled substance, cocaine is somewhat more problematic. Crack cocaine is pure cocaine that pops or cracks when it is smoked. Powdered cocaine is cocaine mixed with various impurities in a powder form. As we know, cocaine causes intense stimulation in terms of the heart rate and can cause rages in some people. It is also one of the most commonly used drugs short of marijuana in the United States. In terms of simple possession, should we make a distinction between casual use and chronic use in terms of criminalizing possession of cocaine? Or should we treat both types of possession the same? In the case of chronic use of cocaine, should we prefer rehabilitative treatment before possession becomes criminal? Should we consider the casual or chronic use of cocaine as a substitute for harder drugs, especially methamphetamines? Generally speaking, should we become less restrictive about the use of softer drugs as a way of preventing the use of harder ones? Heroin and methamphetamines are Schedule I substances under our controlled substance schedule. As such, they are each recognized to have harmful physical effects, especially when they become addictive. Given those addictive effects, should these substances remain criminalized? Should we make a differentiation between simple possession and sale or delivery of these narcotics? Should we provide rehabilitative services when a defendant is first charged with possession or use of same? Should these offenses be eligible not only for rehabilitative services first, but also the potential for expungement down the road in the event of a controlled substance conviction? And should we provide for the use of prison time and space for violation of these controlled substance laws with more time for harder drugs than softer ones? Like it or not, the United States is no longer in the position to afford criminalizing all five controlled substances under our present laws. We simply are not as rich a country as we were before 2008, and arguably, we cannot afford the use of valuable prison space or probation time for all of these various substance abuse offenses, as we've done before. This is true, particularly in light of the fact that the drug problem now is just as big or bigger than it was when the war on drugs began some 35 years ago. We must use our resources more wisely, since we have less of them. The bottom line is this. We need to consider how we can modify our present drug policies to take into account the reality of punishment that we can no longer afford and the ever-changing nature of our nation's drug problem. We must provide strong prevention programs that present facts, not merely scare tactics. Moreover, when it comes to addiction, we must ensure the availability of rehabilitative services for the various drug offenders. We need a better balanced and more thoughtful national drug policy. These choices will not be easy, and they should be taken over a gradual period of time. But our financial reality necessitates them. Let the discussion begin and continue. Chapter 13, Mike Nifong, the rest of the story. Unless you were living under a rock, there is no way you could have missed the Duke men's lacrosse cases. On March 13, 2006, three young men from the Duke lacrosse team were charged with second-degree rape and second-degree kidnapping of a young black woman. I won't mention the names of the three young men. They've had enough bad publicity. The cases carried every iota of tension in the American criminal justice system. Rich versus poor, white versus black, male versus female. The national media descended upon Durham like a media mob. Television trucks were parked around the entire Durham County Courthouse. Maybe 15 or 20 TV trucks in all. On any given day, when some matter was to be heard regarding the Duke men's lacrosse case, the building was jammed with reporters. I remember walking over a number of them on the sixth floor. The reporters were sitting down on the floor eating lunch between the morning and afternoon hearings. Each of the charged defendants paid their $400,000 bond in cash. Think about that for a minute. How many of you have $400,000 in cash? Not many, I suspect. They hired some of the best criminal lawyers in North Carolina. Bill Cotter, Wade Smith, Douglas Kingsbury, Buddy Connor, James Cooney, Joe Cheshire, Brad Bannon, and the now deceased Kirk Osborne. Mike Nifong had been appointed chief district attorney in 2005, replacing Jim Hardin, who ascended to the Supreme Court bench. Nifong had 27 years of prior experience in the district attorney's office. He served as chief assistant under both Hardin and his predecessor, Ron Stephen. At that time, I thought that Nifong was a good choice. Shortly after the story broke, Nifong went on a media offensive. He was simply not going to let rich white Duke students buy justice. "I'm not going to let that happen," Nifong said. He gave interviews to 50 or 60 media outlets, but under the Code of Professional Conduct, pretrial publicity is very much discouraged. Nifong was not a political animal. As an assistant in the district attorney's office, he filed as a Republican to avoid any chance that he would be drafted to run as chief district attorney. Durham is a solidly Democratic county and has been so for years. Nifong didn't like politics. He thought they were a waste of time. Lawyers for the defendants went on the attack, proclaiming that their clients were not simply not guilty, they were innocent. The entire Duke men's lacrosse team, save one, gave their DNA to authorities. None of their DNA matched the DNA found inside the victim. The case moved at breakneck speed. Most criminal cases begin in district court, but these cases skipped that court and moved up to Superior Court immediately. In the meantime, Nifong was facing a tough bid for re-election against Freda Black, who was well known because she was one of the prosecutors in the State versus Michael Peterson murder case several years before. There was also no love lost between the two. When Nifong took over as chief district attorney, he fired Black almost immediately. In such a close race, the outcome often turns on who gets the endorsement from the Committee on Black Affairs, a powerful political pact within the city. Nifong got the committee endorsement. He defeated Black by less than 1,000 votes. At the time, I had also endorsed Nifong. I simply felt that he was the best candidate. It was nothing personal. When the DNA test results came back and showed that they were negative, not only against the white members of the Duke men's lacrosse team, but also of the three defendants charged, Nifong had an opportunity to dismiss the charges. He declined to do so. After he was reelected, he had another chance to dismiss the charges. Again, he refused to do so. I think Nifong truly believed that something happened in that bathroom at 608 Buchanan Street, across from the East Campus of Duke University. But believing something and proving something are two very different things. Moreover, Nifong was facing defendants who had substantial resources with which to defend themselves. In a fight, it was my experience that the rich usually did not take prisoners. Nifong needed to be careful, and he was not. Ultimately, the case was transferred to North Carolina Attorney General Roy Cooper. His office investigated the case in great detail. After completion of the investigation, Cooper announced that he was dismissing the charges against the three lacrosse players. His 15-minute statement to that effect was carried on television statewide. His words were damning and damaging, and questioned Nifong's ability to have reviewed the cases properly early in the process, much less later. Cooper was furious. I could hear it in his voice. I've known Roy for a long time. We were classmates at the University of North Carolina, where I knew him well. Next, the state bar filed an ethics complaint against Nifong, accusing him of making misleading and inflammatory comments to the media about the athletes under suspicion. Later, the bar complaint was amended, accusing him of withholding evidence from the defense and lying to both the court and the bar investigators. In light of his prior service to the state, I suspect that Nifong was offered some sort of plea. But I don't know the details, and I decline to speculate here. If there was a plea, Nifong rejected it. His case went before the Disciplinary Hearings Commission in Raleigh. I went so far as to have a lengthy conversation with Nifong's attorney, David Friedman, a lawyer from Winston-Salem. I was convinced that Nifong was going down in flames, but my arguments and the arguments of others were to no avail. Nifong was disbarred. His legal career was destroyed. His reputation was irrevocably damaged. It was worse than a Greek tragedy. We all know this part of the story, but not the rest. Media attention often focuses on the controversial and leaves the boring and mundane out. Up front, I will tell you that Mike Nifong is a friend of mine. We opposed each other in two capital cases. His trials were clean and rarely overturned on appeal. He was straight up and expected the same from everyone. Yes, Nifong was a little bit arrogant, but I would argue to you that most trial lawyers are to some extent. Consider what we have to deal with every day. Between the early 1980s and 1995, Nifong was simply the best criminal trial lawyer in the district attorney's office. He was the go-to guy. He tried between 60 and 70 murder cases in that period. He tried four capital murder cases as well. Over 10 years ago, in 1995, Nifong was diagnosed with prostate cancer. A normal PSA test is 4 and or under. Nifong's was above 500. He underwent extensive surgery, chemotherapy, and radiation. He was out of the office for some 8 weeks. For a long time after that, Nifong simply could not handle going back into a Superior Court courtroom. So he was relegated to making traffic pleas in traffic court. I can't imagine how that must have felt to him, working out pleas in a speeding case instead of handling murder cases. I'm not telling you this to gain sympathy for Nifong. The national media missed this part of the story, too. I believe that it might help explain why Nifong ran for re-election in 2006, when earlier he supposedly had told Governor Mike Easley that he would not. I still find it difficult to believe that a sitting governor would waste political capital on a countywide case. I am a person who is chronically ill, so the question of lifetime health insurance is critical to me. Judges, district attorneys, and other executives in state government vest judicial health insurance after 5 years of service to the state. It is the gold standard of health insurance in North Carolina. It has saved me thousands of dollars since my first hospitalization in June of 2006. Adding up the time from his appointment in 2005 until the end of his next term in 2010, Nifong would vest judicial health insurance. While his cancer appeared to be cured, there was always the chance that it would reoccur. I haven't asked him, but I believe that judicial health insurance was a strong motivating factor for Nifong to run for re-election in 2006. The national media missed that part of the story, too. In a major controversy, the media seldom gets the whole story, focusing instead on the controversy, which sells newspapers or creates a bigger audience on their television shows. I'm not saying that Nifong is innocent of the various charges brought against him. He made mistakes, big and serious mistakes. But he needs to be viewed in the context of his entire professional career. The national media ultimately failed to do that too. So, as the late radio commentator Paul Harvey used to say, now, the rest of the story. Mike Nifong is still a friend of mine. He always will be. When you try capital cases together as lawyers, you always seem to be joined at the hip somehow. For the life of me, I do not know how he and his wife survived this whole ordeal. And there is more to come on the civil side. A lot of people in Durham wish it would just be over. Enough is enough. You don't kick a man when he's down. When the time is right, I wish that Mike Nifong would tell us the honest truth about what happened. I think he would be surprised by the public's reception. After all, the public likes contrition, especially from public servants. I recommend it, since I have done it before myself. In the end, the public must balance one very bad year against 26 prior good years. You get to decide. Chapter 14, Eve Carson and Abhijit Mahato. I first heard about the murder of Abhijit Mahato, a Duke graduate student, on January 19, 2008. He was shot in the head in his apartment. Robbery appeared to be the motive. There were no leads, and the case was rather cold until 2 months later. Mr. Mahato was 29 years old, a native of India, seeking graduate school training at the Pratt School of Engineering at Duke. He was a serious student, by all accounts, but he liked to joke around, too. He had many friends. He seemed to be a very nice guy. At the time of his death, Abhijit was a second-year graduate student and was planning to take his qualifying exams the next week. His advisor at Duke, Ted Larson, characterize Mahatu as an intellectually curious and exceptionally kind, outgoing man. Quote, he made friends very easily and always had a smile on his face. Our research team was particularly close to Abhijit. He was such a pleasure to be around. He always went out of his way to engage with people and would stop whatever he was doing and help anyone who asked. I was particularly struck by how very well-read in both poetry and literature Abhijit was and how much he enjoyed conversation with others about what they were reading, unquote. At the time of his death, Mahatu was just another murder in Durham. A proud son of India, he had a mother, a father, and a family, just like any other victim. On March 5th, 2008, I first heard about the murder of a young woman in Chapel Hill. The authorities could not identify her at first. Not until the next day, March 6th, did we learn that the body was that of Eve Carson, the student body president of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. She was the first student body president in the United States to be murdered while in office. A bio of Eve on the UNC website had the following. A native of Athens, Georgia, Eve was born November 19, 1985. She came to Carolina in the fall of 2004 as the recipient of a prestigious Morehead Scholarship. A member of the Phi Beta Kappa Honor Society, she was a pre-medicine student majoring in both political science and biology. As a North Carolina fellow, she was part of a four-year leadership development program for undergraduates. While at UNC Chapel Hill, Eve was extremely active in both leadership and service roles. A student body president, she was also a member of the UNC Chapel Hill Board of Trustees. She served as co-president of the Honors Program Student Executive Board and as a member of the Committee on Scholarships, Award, and Student Aid, the Academic Advising Program, and the Chancellor's Committee for University Teaching Awards. Eve was full of energy, ideas, and absolute vitality. Like Mahatu, her future was cut short by senseless violence. Chapel Hill was stunned. We all were. As the days went by, we all watched the authorities develop their case piece by piece. Her car was found at the intersection of Hillcrest Circle and Hillcrest Drive, abandoned. An ATM photograph of one of the defendants was also found. Of course, the accused had to come from Durham. Yet another stain on the reputation of the Bull City. When I was the judge in first appearance court at the Durham County Jail, I usually listened to the 10 p.m. news the night before. I would listen carefully to the body bag count to see who might be appearing in front of me the next morning. I learned that the authorities had arrested Lawrence Levette and Demario Atwater for both the Carson and the Mahatu murders. Levette would appear in front of me Friday morning for the murder of Abhijit Mahatu. Lovely, I thought to myself. Just my luck. I wanted to reassure the public during the course of first appearance. To be safe, I called the powers that be in Raleigh when I got in that morning. They told me to be careful. I poured my cup of coffee, spilling it all over my khakis and the office floor, as usual. I sighed. Blind people should not pour their own coffee. But I was determined, and I always wore khaki pants to hide the coffee stains. 20 minutes later, as I was leaving my office to go to the Durham County Jail, the phone rang again. It was the powers that be for a second time. They were emphatic. They told me not to say anything about the case or the underlying facts. I was not to say a word about the lack of resources in the judicial branch, and that I should just do my job. As I traveled by car to the Durham County Jail, I thought about what they had said. The circumstances of the cases, two students, one a graduate and one an undergraduate, one from the University of North Carolina and the other from Duke University, had been senselessly murdered. Carson's murder was especially savage. It struck me as a gang initiation. I had good reason to think that. Besides the savageness of it all, there were three other clues. Lawrence Levette had a website with a lot of gang graffiti. And on the night of the murder, Levette had been photographed at a bank ATM wearing a Houston Astros baseball cap with Crip colors. This is Wayne Wagner for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is designed for a print and visually impaired audience. We will continue with the book Blind Justice by Judge Craig Brown next week.